Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today I'm joined by Lucia Raffinelli, who is the author of Promoting Justice Across Borders, The Ethics of Reform Intervention. This book was published in 2021 by Oxford University Press, and it is a combination of an understanding about international relations and political theory and the idea of justice. But I'm going to ask Lucia to tell us all about that as we welcome her to the podcast and start off by asking her to tell us a little bit about herself and how she came to this project. Hello, Lucia.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Sure. So I guess to start off with a little bit about myself, I'm an assistant professor now at George Washington, and I'm in the political science department and in the Elliott School for International Affairs. I did my graduate work, which this book is based on, at Princeton, and I had a one-year postdoc after that at Chapman University out in California, where I also was fortunate to do a manuscript workshop on an early version of this manuscript. As far as how I sort of came to thinking about the book itself and the ideas in the book, I guess there are a few different motivating thoughts behind the book. One is just that there's really a lot of variety in global politics. There are a lot of actors out there that are exerting influence on each other in lots of different ways. And in political theory, at least in normative political theory where I work, there's a big literature on the ethics of intervention, but it's, with some exceptions, pretty narrowly focused on state-led interventions and military or kind of traditionally coercive interventions. So like military humanitarian intervention is the kind of paradigm case that a lot of the literature talks about. And so one motivation behind the book was to try to expand that discussion, to think about other cases, other kinds of interventions, other actors besides states, and other ways that they try to promote their own ideas about justice around the world, not just via military force or coercion, but by all kinds of other kind of tactics. And another motivating thought behind the book was that if we paid attention to this very wide variety of different forms that intervention can take, that we might come to think differently about the ethics of intervention than, you know, I think many of us often do. In particular, the idea was that there are lots of really serious moral objections to intervention that are very credible and often decisive against some kinds of intervention, but that doesn't mean that they're sort of decisive against all kinds of intervention. And so the goal of the book in that sense was to develop sort of a more nuanced set of ethical standards that we could use to judge when interventions of lots of different types were or were not morally justified.
And when we're talking about interventions, and you sort of started off by explaining that, you know, there's the big, but yet narrow school of thought in both international relations and political theory around the kinds of interventions. And so most people listening would think about, okay, so the United States intervened in a variety of countries economically. We've intervened with military capacity for peacekeeping. You know, we intervened in military capacity, perhaps not for peacekeeping. So can you just back up and define a little bit more about what what this narrowness is with regard to interventions, but also to some degree, how to expand thinking about it.
Yeah, sure. So the book is about a category that I call reform intervention, which I mean to be pretty broad. So it includes any attempt to promote justice in another society. So any sort of deliberate attempt to promote justice in another society. And the reason for making that category so broad is that I think that any attempt to promote justice in another society is going to involve a lot of the same moral issues and raise a lot of the same moral questions, even if, you know, the exact kind of ethical standards that we should use to evaluate that intervention, you know, might change based on, say, who is doing the intervening or the tactics that they use or other kind of contextual elements of the case. So I talk about a few different cases in the book, so maybe it would be helpful just to sort of, you know, preview some of those to kind of illustrate the range of things that I'm interested in talking about here. So, for example, one case I talk about is the Palestinian Boycott, Divest, Sanction movement, so which, of course, has a lot of different parts to it. But one part that I find particularly interesting is the consumer boycott part. So here's kind of, in one sense, it's an intervention in that it's Palestinian civil society actors and other actors around the world who are trying to produce policy changes in Israel. But it's not necessarily, you know, taking that conventional form of, you know, military intervention, or at least in the consumer boycott aspect of it, it's not, you know, coercive economic sanctions or anything like that. But it's rather, you know, trying to motivate lots of individual consumers to use their purchasing power in certain ways to encourage or discourage, you know, certain political changes. Another case I talk about is back in 2010, Arizona passed a kind of now infamous anti-immigration bill, which kind of did lots of things, some of which were ultimately struck down by the Supreme Court. For example, it said that police could check someone's immigration status based only on the officer's, quote, reasonable suspicion that they might be undocumented, required all immigrants to acquire immigration registration records. It criminalized them taking jobs. It allowed warrantless arrest based on only police suspicion that someone was undocumented. And in the wake of this law, which was challenged and opposed, several Latin American countries got together and submitted amicus briefs to the U.S. Supreme Court opposing the law. And one of the things they did in their sort of briefs was argue that this law was going to unfairly target not only Latin American countries' citizens who happened to be in the United States, but also just other Latinx appearing people who were in the United States and, you know, would be unfairly targeted by this law. And so here is a case where we have these Latin American countries trying to produce a policy change in the United States and invoking kind of concerns of justice kind of in defense of that. But they're doing it, you know, via the legal institutions of the United States itself. I won't go through all the cases I talk about in the book, but just to sort of list some types. So I talk about international NGO work. I talk about conditional trade agreements as a sort of one form of intervention. I talk about the recent European export ban on lethal injection drugs to the United States and other places. So that's kind of the range of cases that I talk about in the book. And to go, you know, maybe back to your original question, I think again, when we focus on and think about intervention as only involving that sort of paradigmatic case, you know, state military humanitarian intervention, we kind of miss out on the wealth of other forms that intervention can take and what moral issues, you know, they raise.
And it's the moral issues or this sort of nebulous and giant question of justice that is also sort of engaging what you're looking at. And so we often talk about, and this is often in a binary way, right, that there's particular interventions that are for good, making the world safe for democracy, shall we say, or, you know, to protect a particular way of life, or the integrity of a country. And part of what you're talking about is that we shouldn't necessarily also be bound by these kind of contexts of state borders before we get into the question of justice, that this is not, you know, just states against states in a certain sense. Can you explain a little bit about that, about the across border component?
Yeah, definitely. So I think one, you know, you're right. One thing that I try to do in the book is to show that there are kind of all these different ways that different political actors, including individuals, can engage in politics that crosses borders. And also to make the argument that some of that is morally permissible, and that maybe even some of the time we have a moral obligation to do some of that. And in that sense, one kind of takeaway from the book, or one thing I argue for in the book, is that the project of achieving justice is not something that we should think of as a project we can only take on kind of with our fellow citizens within our own society, but it's a project that everyone in the world should take on. And that's kind of the legitimate political concern of everybody. And so, I think one goal of the book is, again, by investigating the ethics of these different types of interventions and by kind of expanding the scope of what we're talking about when we talk about intervention, is again to show that some of those ways of intervening in other societies can be morally permissible, even if, you know, we're right to think that many interventions, maybe of that paradigmatic, you know, state military intervention kind in the past, have been morally objectionable. That doesn't mean we have to kind of write off the whole practice of engaging with people in other societies in order to promote justice.
And so this idea of sort of a moral issue and moral permissibility or moral constraint sort of starts to get us towards this question of justice. My students always get mad at me when I teach political theory because we read, you know, Plato's Republic, and of course, justice is never really found. And they get really frustrated because it's a long book. So as you know, anybody in the political theory business. So in this question of justice that is sort of wrapping your research and to some degree your discussion of intervention, obviously, what are we talking about? Not Socrates, obviously, but how do we get our hands around this idea of morally permissible, morally appropriate, leaning towards justice?
Great. Yeah, thank you. So you're right. I mean, of course, I can kind of say in the abstract, oh, yes, interventions that promote justice. But there's this looming question of what actually does justice require? I do say something about that in the book, though I don't defend a full theory of justice. I don't kind of defend a full view about what all the requirements of justice are. And there's a reason for that. Well, there are a couple of reasons for it. One is that I think, you know, one of the really pressing and interesting and important moral questions that the book is trying to address is, how do we as political actors who are kind of put in the position of making choices about how to do political action, and who know that, you know, there are all of these competing views out there about what justice requires, how do we sort of promote or advocate for what we see as justice in a way that is still respectful of and acknowledging the fact that other people out there may disagree with us about what justice requires, and, you know, that recognizes those people as equals, moral equals to us, as people who make weighty claims about what justice requires and about how their lives should go. So insofar as the book is trying to, you know, give us some standards that we can use to kind of promote what we see as justice, given that we know there is this pervasive disagreement about what justice requires, its goal is not really to answer all those questions about what justice requires, but to kind of give us a way that we can hopefully engage, even across borders, in the project of trying to achieve justice when we know that, first of all, we're fallible judges about what justice requires, and second of all, that other people are going to disagree with us about what justice requires. And so one of the things I say in the book is that I think there's a lot about the question of what justice requires that is intentionally left open in the book, though it's not, you know, all left open. So I do take some generally liberal principles to be, you know, I kind of take them as given as a starting point. So the idea that people are moral equals, the idea that justice requires that people be empowered to develop and pursue their own life projects, that people have basic rights to life, to some minimal amount of bodily security, to the resources necessary for achieving some threshold level of functioning in their society, to an adequate range of options for the course of their life, to freedom of conscience, to democratic, in some sense, government. That, you know, people have a right to equal opportunity, and that whatever inequalities are present kind of in our socioeconomic sphere should be justifiable in some way to the people who are disadvantaged. And so I kind of take those things, those values as a starting point, though there's still a lot, I mean, those are very general intentionally, there's still a lot to work out about what those would all mean. And I kind of intentionally leave a more specific, you know, answer to the question of what justice requires open for the purposes of the book.
And one of the points that you also sort of make, you make it very, very much in the brief introduction, but you also sort of take this up in the case, in some of the case studies that you are looking at, is the perspectives that are coming into conflict or tension around how one can intervene and be respectful. And I had a student this past year who was writing a capstone thesis on feminism in Morocco and Tunisia, and getting to the definition of Islamic feminism was really important in terms of understanding feminism and also, you know, interventions on behalf of women's equality that wasn't Western in a lot of ways. And I think this is also a lot of what you're sort of talking about in terms of like, how does intervention work in a way that is not heavy-handed?
Yeah, definitely. And one of the you know, main threads in the book is this idea that one dimension along which interventions can differ is the degree of control that the interveners are exercising over the recipients of the intervention. So there are some interventions, you know, where the interveners really are forcing recipients to kind of acquiesce to interveners' wishes. And maybe that's often what the paradigmatic, you know, military intervention looks like. But again, once we recognize that there are lots of other ways to intervene, we can also see that some interventions don't involve interveners exercising that degree of control, or really even any control in some cases, over recipients. So there are some interventions that are really more, you know, they look more like advocacy. They're more about persuasion. So one of the other cases I mentioned briefly before that I talk about in the book is the case of Tostan, which is an international NGO that does basically democracy and human rights and public health promotion work in Western Africa. And they have an interesting model. One of their sort of core goals, or has become one of their core goals over the years, has been to get the communities they work with to publicly declare that they will end female genital cutting. And they've achieved that goal in a lot of different communities. And so there's a sense in which, you know, they're trying to kind of uproot practices that are in some cases well entrenched, you know, that some people have argued have a kind of significant tie to the local cultures there. But they're doing it in a way that doesn't, in my view, involve them actually exercising any control over the communities they work with or sort of forcing those communities to change their ways. So the model is basically that they run these sort of community-based education classes that talk about public health and democracy and women's rights and all kinds of other topics. Those classes are taught in local languages. The curricula were collaboratively designed originally with participants themselves from the local communities. And another thing that Tostan tries to do is to set up basically local governance kind of committees that will outlast the presence of Tostan itself. And so their model is, I argue in the book, very much about empowering local people to sort of take charge of their own, you know, the way their own community is going to go forward and organize itself. And, you know, they have an agenda in that they're trying to promote democratic governance, they're trying to promote human rights, they're trying to promote women's rights. But at the end of the day, it seems to be, you know, the people in those local communities themselves who have the right to decide whether or not they're going to take on any of Tostan's recommendations and, you know, more specifically, how they're going to kind of drive their community's development forward in what direction. That's, you know, that's left up to them. So in cases like that, I think, you know, there's a promising model there, because it does seem to be the case that, you know, though we have an intervention happening, at the end of the day, it's still the people in the recipient community who decide for themselves what their society is going to look like. So they're deciding that, you know, kind of in response to input from elsewhere. They're not necessarily being forced or coerced or even incentivized to do it in one way or another.
And this example of Tostan is also an interesting sort of idea of local control, right? That it's not coming from an international community. It's not coming from, per se, another country that's coming here and sort of wagging its finger and saying, you need to do it this way. But this is also, you know, sort of when we think about the federalist system in the United States, there's a lot that is discussed about how local control, local capacity is something that is much more reflective of the people who are there, who are experiencing whatever the policy is. Can you explain a little bit about how this is also a nuance in terms of our understanding of how international relations works?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. The idea of local control definitely is playing a role here. And, you know, I end up arguing in the book that in a lot of cases, for a few different reasons, interventions that are, you know, kind of collaborative in some way with the local population, or that, you know, leave a lot of decision power up to the local population, are going to be more desirable than other kinds of interventions where the interveners are exercising more control. That might be because, you know, those interventions where local control is more prominent are more effective, right? They sort of take root in a more permanent way. But also, you know, I think it can be for the reasons I kind of just described, those interventions can show a degree of respect for the local population as people who have legitimate claims of their own to kind of decide how their own society is going to be run. I think maybe where the sort of nuance comes in is the idea that, in my view anyway, you know, we can value local control without having to think that there can be no influence at all from the outside, right? So if we value, you know, local control or collective self-determination of a given community, I don't think that means that we have to think, you know, this community must be completely isolated from any external influences. And I think sometimes, you know, sometimes at least some people have the tendency to kind of go too far in that direction, to think, well, if we want, you know, local people to control their own destiny, then that means there just can be no influence from any other community, from anywhere else in the world. And, you know, I think one of the things I'm trying to do in the book, again, by kind of highlighting the variety of these different forms that influence can take, is to show that not all of it is, you know, sort of scary and tyrannical and oppressive, but it can take good forms as well. And, you know, maybe I should add, I think in another one of the recommendations I end up making in the book is that we should adopt a sort of presumption in favor of what I call counter-hegemonic interventions. So interventions that sort of challenge existing geopolitical power hierarchies, where the interveners themselves maybe occupy a less powerful position than the recipients. So like that intervention from the Latin American countries into the U.S. that I described earlier. And if we, you know, think of intervention as also perhaps happening in that direction too, I think that's, you know, another way in which we can maybe make it, we can recognize that it doesn't always have to look so scary and oppressive and, you know, imperialistic.
And I wanted to ask you specifically about that because I was really struck by the way that you sort of put this in the conclusion of the book that, you know, we often think about the intervention, particularly coming from the perspective of somebody in the United States, as the United States intervening someplace else because we are so big and powerful and mighty and economically strong and militarily strong and we know what's right also. But that, as you say, there's also the flip side of that, that if an NGO or a country is going to intervene or an international organization is going to intervene, then they also have to be open to being, to having that intervention themselves, which is again, something that is not usually in the scope of the traditional understanding of intervention. And I know you mentioned the amicus briefs by the Latin American countries with regard to the Arizona legislation, but can you expand sort of this concept of this more of a two-way street?
Yeah, definitely. So I think one other thing I say in relation to this in the book is that if we really do come to the conclusion that achieving justice or pursuing justice is this project, not just that we should do with our fellow citizens, but that kind of everyone in the world should be doing together. Of course, that may mean that we have moral reasons or moral obligations to try to pursue justice or help justice be achieved in other societies. But it also is going to mean that we have moral reasons and perhaps moral obligations to kind of open ourselves up to potentially justice promoting influence from other places in the world, right? And I think that's part of recognizing what I was saying before, that we are all fallible judges about what justice requires. You know, there's no reason to think that the United States, for example, has lots to teach everywhere else in the world about justice, but nothing to learn from anywhere else in the world about justice. So I think if we, are really committed to that kind of view, this is one conclusion of it, that, not only should, those big, powerful countries that we often think of as the interveners, maybe sometimes they should be intervening, but they also should be kind of opening themselves up to influences from outside in a way that I think, they're often reluctant to.
And you have some ideas about how that can happen. Can you explain a little bit about how that can be developed? Because again, you're advocating in the book, it's an interesting advocacy. You're advocating in the book for many people globally to take a much different perspective. And that's where the political theory comes in also on how do we think about intervention and why intervention?
Yeah, so as far as ways that we might sort of actualize or operationalize this goal, or how we might put it into practice in the real world, I think there are a few things that we can do in relatively short order. So, of course, in the very long term, you might think, well, we should have some kind of global institutions that will, formally facilitate kind of exchange of information and ideas, maybe making policy that are maybe, more robust and reliable than the global institutions we have now. But I take it that that's, a very, 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 very long-term goal. And so we do need something to kind of be able to say and do in the here and now. And so I do think that, looking to, for example, social movements, transnational social movements, BDS is one, example of that, but there are others. I think, those are a kind of model maybe of how ideas and, in particular ideas about justice and, strategies, right, political strategies and political mobilization can exist in ways that kind of transcend or kind of exist outside of maybe formal international or formal global institutions, but in ways that still cross borders and still, show the potential to kind of produce political changes across borders. I also think, we have lots of kind of not only advocacy groups, but, NGOs and kind of organizations that produce lots of information about lots of different areas of the world and from the perspectives of, you know, different people around the world. And those are, you know, I think more than ever now kind of readily available to many global political actors. And so another thing that we might think about doing is just to actively seek out, you know, information and ideas and perspectives from people in, you know, elsewhere in the world and who are sort of differently situated than us. And that can be part of, you know, doing our due diligence to try to open ourselves individually and also as societies up to kind of influence from elsewhere.
And that was actually my next question. And so you beat me to the punch a little bit there in terms of, because part of what you're talking about in terms of a kind of sort of individual advocacy is that we should all be involved in thinking about how we personally engage with this question of justice and intervention. And again, this is, you know, possibly a tall order. And, you know, we have seen movements like fair labor movements that are transnational. Obviously, something like BDS, which is you know, very narrowly focused in terms of an outcome, but, you know, is a global reach. Can you explain a little bit about how, you know, somebody sitting in suburban Wisconsin can sort of activate myself according to what you're discussing in the book?
Sure. Yes, you're right that I think, you know, there should be some kind of individual level uptake to these ideas. And I think part of that is just, you know, recognizing the roles that we already often play and occupy in global politics, even if they're, you know, often somewhat indirect. Of course, there are, you know, explicitly political moments, right? We choose, you know, who to vote for, maybe, you know, we choose what kinds of foreign policies to support in so far as we have, you know, influence as citizens and voters over that kind of thing. But, you know, also we choose what companies to patronize. We may choose, you know, to donate to a particular charity or NGO and not another one. You know, we may choose to exercise our sort of free speech and, you know, express support or opposition to different proposed interventions. And so I think those are all ways in which, even as individuals, you know, we do have some channels open to us to kind of engage with these global political questions. And I think part of what, you know, the book is trying to push people to do is to do that in a conscious way and a reflective way, and a way that's kind of, you know, alive to some of the moral questions that I think are raised by these different kinds of intervention.
And so one of my questions that follows that is, I mean, I understand the example that you present with regard to BDS, and I understand some of the other examples that you've given, but, you know, something like global climate change seems to be an opportune capacity or opportune issue area for many people in many ways to be involved across borders in trying to promote global climate justice, because it is also disadvantaging people who are generally already disadvantaged. Can you talk a little bit about something like global climate change as fitting into the various theories that you're teasing out here?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that, you know, insofar as it as sort of opposition to, you know, as you call it, climate injustice is an issue of justice, you know, it definitely would be, or advocacy for climate justice definitely would kind of fall in the scope of, you know, what the theory in the book wants to talk about. So, for example, there was a lawsuit by some actors in India against the IFC a few years ago, basically, you know, saying that the IFC, which is a World Bank sort of subsidiary, if I remember correctly, sort of caused a bunch of pollution in this Indian community, which basically threatened their subsistence. This is not, you know, climate change precisely, though it is sort of environmental justice. And so, I mean, something like that could be a potential, you know, model for advocacy around these issues. But I also think, as you were sort of suggesting earlier, you know, just the idea that there could be transnational social movements, as, you know, we've seen kind of global protests that have been somewhat coordinated around the idea of climate justice and generational justice connected with that. You know, I think that could be another model. And you know, maybe that's a model also that, you know, sort of fits into this category of maybe less controlling interventions, you know, where the interveners, we want to call them, you know, the social movement activists, the protesters are not necessarily, you know, forcing in all cases anyone to adopt a particular policy, though they're kind of exerting pressure, exerting influence. I think another, you know, interesting thing that we saw, you know, after the U.S. kind of withdrew from the Paris Accords, right, we saw some individual cities within the U.S., you know, stepping up and saying, you know, actually, we are going to stand by these environmental standards or adopt environmental standards of our own. And so that was maybe another instance in which, you know, in some cases, you might think it's international insofar as there's solidarity among these, you know, different, maybe different cities around the world, but it's also just an example of, you know, maybe the political institutions that you don't normally think of as the big, you know, movers and shakers in this area kind of stepping in to exert that sort of influence. So I think, you know, in that sense, it's true that global climate change and climate justice present another, you know, area that's maybe, you know, ripe to be kind of taken advantage of by some of these other models of intervention that aren't the paradigmatic, you know, state military intervention.
And you tip your hat in the conclusion to an area that, you know, you haven't quite had time to go into in the book. So my question for you is, what are you working on now?
Yes. So I am working on what I think is a second book project on the ethics of resistance in global context. And I'm especially interested in the ethics of resistance kind of in communities who are routinely subject to state power and the power of the state system, but also routinely excluded from its exercise. So stateless people, undocumented people, indigenous people, for example. And the hope is to kind of investigate the ethics of resistance in those contexts and use that to tell us something about the legitimacy of perhaps individual states, but also the international state system as a whole. And part of this sort of project is related to something that I mentioned at the very end of the book, which is this idea of epistemic injustice. This idea that, you know, there may be certain certain people or certain communities whose ideas about justice are effectively kind of excluded from mainstream political conversations about what justice requires. And that can itself be a form of injustice. So sort of indebted to Miranda Fricker's conception of epistemic injustice there. And one idea that I've kind of started working with as part of this second project is that perhaps one way to sort of remedy the epistemic injustice that comes from that exclusion is to have healthy sort of resistance culture or spaces of resistance where people and communities who are sort of excluded from mainstream political institutions can develop, formulate, and communicate their ideas about justice kind of on their own terms, not necessarily constrained by the rules of those very institutions that sort of exclude them or render their ideas unintelligible. And I think that creating those spaces and sort of being open to learning from them is probably going to be part of what we're obligated to do in that endeavor to sort of open ourselves up to knowledge and ideas about justice from elsewhere, from other communities, from other places around the world.
Well, I look forward to talking to you about that book once it's completed, if you'll come back on the New Books in Political Science podcast.
Yes, of course. That would be great. Thank you.
Because it felt like there was like, I felt like there was, you know, a to be continued part of the book right there at the end. Like, oh, I see what's happening next.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It's good. It's good news for the second project.
I'd like to thank Lucia Raffinali for talking to me about Promoting Justice Across Borders, The Ethics of Reform Intervention, which is published by Oxford University Press in 2021. I assume this is available at the Oxford University Press website. Is there a brick and mortar store that you'd like to give a shout out to?
I mean, I'm sure it's available at many academic bookstores. You're right that it is available at the Oxford University Press website. Also, there is a discount code in case people are interested. ASFLYQ6 will get you 30% off at the Oxford University Press website.
All right. Thank you so much for that. And thank you for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to talk.
It's my pleasure.